Members and other members, start the meeting and call the meeting to order at this time. Get moving forward with some testimony so we can get done at a reasonable point. We don't have a quorum yet, so we'll take a look at the minutes in a little bit. But nonetheless, let's get started with today's testimony. And we're going to be looking at a couple of things, rural issues and 911 issues. And we're fortunate to have Randy Young here from the Minnesota Association for Rural Telecommunications. Mr. Young, for the record, if you'd identify yourself and go forward with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randy Young, and I'm president of the Minnesota Association for Rural Telecommunications. And we certainly appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, of being able to make a presentation this morning to talk a little bit about what's going on in rural Minnesota as far as telecommunications goes. There are five things that I'd like to cover today, if it is all right with the committee. First is just an overview of the rural telecommunications companies in the state, the technology that we're deploying, and then I have Monty Morrow with me, who is from Hutchinson Telephone Company, to kind of give you a case study, a real live telephone company that's operating in Hutchinson, Minnesota, the challenges that we're facing, and then a short video that kind of highlights what can be done in rural Minnesota with broadband deployment as far as economic development is concerned. To give you a bit of an overview, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, of the rural telephone company industry in the state, we have over 80 independent telephone companies in Minnesota. No one has ever been able to give me a good answer as to why over 25% of all the telephone companies in the country are in Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. But for some reason, through some fluke of history, these three contiguous states have over 25% of all the telephone companies, with us having 80-plus. About a third of them are co-ops. About two-thirds of them are family-owned companies, ranging in size from just a couple of hundred customers up to the largest being maybe 20,000 customers. We serve over 300 communities in greater Minnesota with about 340,000 customers in those communities. We serve less than 10% of all the access lines in the state. If you throw in cellular, we're probably down to about 5% of the access lines. In spite of that, we serve half of the geography of Minnesota. So we serve very sparsely populated areas, very small small towns, and obviously when you have that sparsity of population, the cost of deploying technology is substantially higher than it is in the Twin City area or in other large metropolitan areas in the state, such as Rochester or Duluth. Our companies, because we are in small towns, because we are on Main Street, because we are involved in those communities, we do take leadership roles. I did a little survey a few years ago at one of our meetings, and in virtually every one of our companies, the owner, the general manager, or one of the managers is the mayor, is on the city council, is on the school board, heavily committed to our communities. And that's one of the reasons, quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, why we've made the kind of commitment that we have over the years for advancing technology and putting in the infrastructure that our communities are asking for. In the last 6 years, we spent over $300 million putting in technology that's needed to provide broadband internet service, advanced video services, and advanced telecommunications voice services in our communities. One of the reasons that we do it, quite frankly, is because we live in our community. We are very much, as we like to say, coffee shop regulated. We hear from our customers on a daily basis what they need, what they want, what they feel we're not providing. And as a result of that, we're willing to step up to the plate and make the investments often before it makes a whole lot of sense to do it from a business case perspective. From a more practical perspective, we also do it because we know that we have to. Most of our companies serve only three or four or five communities. They know that if their communities aren't doing well economically, that they're not going to do well either. So they need to put in the infrastructure so that their communities are doing well, so that they can survive as a company. We employ over 1,600 employees in Greater Minnesota and pay about $160 million in taxes annually. The map that you see here shows the service areas of the independent telephone companies in the state. Again, the grayish are the independent areas. Half the geography, again, of Minnesota is served by these small independent telephone companies around Minnesota. What you have here is a map that shows the fiber optic network that the local telephone companies in Minnesota have installed over the last number of years. There are over 15,000 route miles of fiber optic cables in the state connecting virtually every city in Minnesota with fiber optics. In many cases, if not most cases, there is more than one route of fiber coming in and going out of a community, so that if there is a fiber cut in one route coming in, it can be automatically routed around to the other fiber so that they're not separated from the rest of the world while the fiber is being cut. Back in the old days, if you had a cut of a copper line, it didn't affect that many customers. Today, with so much traffic going over such a small line, a cut can have a substantial impact on a community, which is why in many cases, if not most cases, we're putting redundant routing coming in from two different directions into our rural communities. One of the big issues today, of course, is broadband deployment. Everyone knows that communities, schools, and individuals are more and more reliant on the internet. Dial-up internet, in a lot of cases, is no longer adequate, and people are looking for broadband as a solution. Our companies realized that a number of years ago and began deploying the network to provide that broadband availability to their customers. Today, over 90% of our customers have got access to broadband internet service. And it's not just the customers that are in our small towns either. Most of our companies have been deploying broadband out into the countryside as well. They'll do that by putting fiber out into a node in the countryside and then using the existing copper from that node out to the farmstead so that farmsteads and people living out in rural areas outside of small towns can have broadband coverage too. As you can see by the sign here, towns as small as Freedom, Minnesota, population 35, have got broadband internet coverage today in our service areas. And we have been increasing that bandwidth over the years as well. It wasn't too many years ago when 256 was considered adequate broadband, and that's what people were asking for, and that's what we were providing. As our customers have begun to ask for more and more bandwidth, we have been deploying the facilities that are needed to increase that bandwidth. So today, a megabyte is pretty much the minimum that all of our companies are offering, many times going up to 2 or 3 megabytes. And when there's a video included with that, it's going up to 20 or 30 megabytes. Much greater bandwidth than we were seeing just a few years ago. And that's necessitated us not only using fiber between our communities, but now putting fiber within each exchange network as well. A survey that we just recently completed showed us that 3/4 of our customers today are being provided their broadband service on fiber that's somewhere in the network. And 1/3 of our customers today have got fiber that's coming right to their home or to their business. And business plans of others of our telephone companies, 1/3 of our companies are providing that. And that number is going to jump to 1/2 of our companies by the end of the construction season next year. That doesn't mean that every one of those companies is at this point being able to provide broadband via fiber to every single home in their serving area. But that's what they're working toward, and we see that goal coming down the road as well. to give you just an idea of what we're talking about when we're talking about the capabilities and capacities of fiber optic cable today, I brought with a couple of examples. Here's a sheath of 600 pair of copper wire. This is what was used not too many years ago to go from city to city that would provide 600 simultaneous voice conversations over these 600 pair. Today that's been replaced with fiber optic cable, and in this cable you'll find 240 strands of fiber optic cable. This cable will provide the equivalent of a voice conversation, a megabit of data, and one video channel simultaneously for every man, woman, and child of school age or above in all of Minnesota and Iowa combined simultaneously on this pipe right here. Now, that's not to say we ought to be throwing away all of the copper because the copper is no good. I think when you're talking about copper between communities, obviously those days are long gone. But within the network, within communities, and within exchanges, copper is still a very valuable resource, besides being stolen. And some of our companies can talk to that. 10 years ago, a piece of twisted pair of copper going out to your home or to your farmstead would provide you with one voice conversation, and people thought that that's about what would be useful over that copper. Today, with the technology that we're able to put on either end of that copper, if it's within 3,000 feet of either a fiber optic node out in the countryside or the central office in town, over that twisted pair copper that 10 years ago we could just do one voice conversation. Today we can do two voice conversations, broadband internet, and three digital video channels all at the same time. So although often people believe that fiber optics is the wave of the future, and certainly it is, copper still has a very important role to play in the network in providing the technology. And the solution so often to these demands for more and more bandwidth isn't necessarily what's laying in the ground, but what you put on either end of what's laying on the ground, whether it's copper or whether it's fiber optic cable. These 240 strand that we were talking about and the capacity that it had, that it has today, 2 or 3 years from now, that capacity may very well be doubled or tripled again because of electronics that we can put on either end of that. Well, that technology is obviously very expensive to deploy. As I said before, we've spent over $300 million in the past few years to deploy that. And you can't get that investment back with just voice service. And as a result, our companies have been going to what we call the triple play and providing both voice, broadband, and video service over those fiber optic wires and those copper wires that we have in the ground today. We understand that we are no longer telephone companies, but that we are communication companies, just as the cable companies have realized that they're no longer just video companies, but communication companies, and are doing the same thing that we're doing in providing voice, broadband, and video over their network. We're doing the same thing as well, understanding that we've got to be providing all of those services, not only to pay for our network, but to provide the services that our customers are asking for as well. Well, we've heard a lot lately, and you've probably read in the press now and then, about how America is falling behind when it comes to broadband deployment. How we're 16th, or we're just behind Bangladesh in our connectivity when you rank the world. Well, statistics can often be misleading, and when you look at them in other terms, we're really doing very well as a country. We're first in the total bandwidth connections that we have, far exceeding the next 10 companies, 10 countries combined in the number of homes and businesses that are connected to broadband internet. And when you take into consideration geography, we're ranked only behind Canada in our connections per population density. It's obviously easy to wire a community or a country like Singapore or Hong Kong or even Korea, where they don't have the vast geographic stretches that we do in this country. And when you take that into consideration, we're only behind Canada. And I would contend that's because the vast majority of the Canadian population is right along the border. There's not much that goes up into the outreaches of Canada.
Mr. Young, we have a question from Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Young, to this, how's the U.S. doing? Your first point, total broadband connections were first. Remember, over the last couple of years, we've had some fascinating discussions about this. Is the key word here in the definition of what constitutes a broadband connection? I know that some of the things we've heard in the past are the Europeans are way ahead of us, but they're talking in terms of up to 90 and 100 megabits. Is that the difference here in what we're defining as broadband? Where do we start that definition?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, that is part of it. And these are FCC statistics that are, I think, 04 or 05, as I recall. And at that point, the FCC was considering broadband to be 256. I agree with you that I'm not sure that that's adequate today. Mm-hmm. Our companies don't believe it's adequate, and that's why we're stepping up the broadband pipe, if you will, that we're providing to our customers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought it was important for the committee to know that 256 used to be the old number, and that's kind of what everyone's keying off of. And I'm thinking today probably most of us would consider 2 or 3 to be the floor. But thanks for
clarifying. Continue then, Mr. Young.
And when you look at Minnesota as compared with other states, we're finding a pretty good story as well. When you're looking at DSL deployment, and again, for our companies, we're talking about a megabit or more, 81% of telephone customers in the state, that's all telephone company customers, large size as well as our small companies, 81% have got access to broadband. That ranks us 11th among the states. And again, with the rural companies, we're over 90% of our customers. Cable, we're ranked 17th, with 91% of their customers having access to their cable modem service as well. There again, though, the cable companies only provide in town, don't go out into the countryside, whereas the telephone companies, by law, are providing telephone service to everyone in their exchange, whether they're out in the countryside or in town. This is a map, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I apologize that it's a little blurred. It's from an FCC report that shows where there's competition for broadband service in Minnesota. If you'll notice, the blue, that's the most outstanding, that's where there are 7 or more companies that are providing competitive broadband services. Not only is the Twin Cities and Duluth and Rochester and Moorhead and those communities depicted in blue, but a lot of the rural areas are depicted in blue, too. Towns as small as Medelia, Minnesota, outside of Mankato, have got 7 competitors for broadband. So it's not today that we just have a single provider almost ubiquitously around the state, except in a few areas up in the boundary waters and in far northern Minnesota. But we have competition in many of those areas as well. At this point, Mr. Chairman, if it's all right with you, I'd like to introduce Monty Morrow from the Hutchinson Telephone Company that can kind of give you a real live story of what the rural telephone companies are doing in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair?
That sounds good. And even before we do that,
just one question on that last slide. Can you talk a little bit about what that competition is? Who makes up, like, when there's 7 or more, what you're talking about there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that varies from community to community. I would guess in most communities it's the telephone company, the cable company, maybe some independent operators that are providing broadband. In some cases it may be some wireless providers as well that are doing it. It tends to be a mix. As is often the case, you look at what is the best technology for the application. In some areas, wireless may make some sense. In other areas, it may not make sense. So it really varies from area to area. But I would say in most situations, it's the cable company and the telephone company, as well as some independents that are in there providing broadband.
Any further questions, members, at this point? If not, before we go on to the next presentation or next part of it, let's take a look at the minutes. Representative Saylor, have you had a chance to review them fairly thoroughly? And do you move their approval?
I do.
Motion to approve the minutes, Representative Saylor. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. And if you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and go ahead with your testimony.
Monty Morrow, Hutchinson Telephone Company. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. I thought I would do a quick snippet of my background. My name is Monty Morrow. I was raised in the telecommunications industry. My father worked for an independent. After that, I went to school. I went to work for an Auerbach. Myself worked there in excess of 15 years in the metro here. So for those of you from the metro, I'm pretty familiar with your services, your offerings, and probably designed some of them. I have since gone back to my independent roots and have lived in Hutchinson for the past 6 years. I'm here today to talk briefly about Hutchinson Telephone Company, give you a quick snippet of what we're doing, what we have, and our ILEC operations, our legacy operations, are out of Hutchinson, Minnesota. We have also turned up a CLEC operation in Litchfield, Minnesota, called Hutchinson Telecommunications. We have offices in both towns. We felt it was important to have a local presence, a local customer service area, local technicians that people know, a place that they can go, come talk to, look, feel, touch services, all those types of things. Today I'm briefly going to touch on a few services that we provide regarding voice, video, data, wireless internet, special access to 911. I'll try not to tread too heavily on 911 for your next presenter, Mr. Whitehead. Hutchinson is located approximately 45 minutes west of the metro. Our serving area is in approximately a 10 to 12 mile radius of the town of Hutchinson itself, about 208 square miles. In the late 90s, we started deploying fiber optic throughout our serving area over the top of our existing copper infrastructure. We completely went and rebuilt our own town with fiber. We have a thing called fiber to the curb topology, which means that the fiber optic cable that Mr. Chair is holding that goes out to a curb, and from there on we're using in most cases copper facilities into the home. Randy touched on some of those specifications, and we'll be more than happy to talk about those as well. We have the same exact topology in Litchfield where our CLEC is. The incumbent there was we felt we needed to offer some more advanced services. And we went there and we rebuilt that town with fiber ourselves. And there's fiber optic coming from our central office out to the curb. There is equipment. Back in the old days, there used to be equipment that would reside in the central office. A great big mainframe computer, if you will. Put that on copper wire and out to the home it went. You can't push the bandwidth and the distances needed for today's technology. So what you do is the equipment has actually been distributed out to the community. And these are what we call RTs. They're anywhere from the size of a mini college fridge up to a full-size deep freeze. And we have 191 of those deployed in our serving area in Hutchinson and 61 of them in our CLEC. Just our ILEC operations alone, we rebuilt our own network with approximately 168, 169 fiber route miles within our own 10 to 12 square mile radius.
Mr. Mugg, just a brief question. Kind of handling the fiber when it's going by there. Did you say the fiber goes to the curb and then does it stop there and go to the home?
Correct. It goes to a piece of equipment. It's a smart cabinet where there are cards. There are video cards, there are data cards, and there are voice cards.
And it goes right to the house.
And it goes right to the house, and it goes there in most cases on the existing copper.
A representative Beard has a question. Hoppeek.
We're interchangeable.
I knew that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're asking a question, I'm just wondering, with this, when you spent the money with this investment, was that all your money, or do you guys get grants from the federal government or any other kind of help, or is that strictly your investment?
It's a combination of both.
Okay.
You know, most telcos there are things, universal service and those type of things that help you build out infrastructure, absolutely. A lot of the stuff and a lot of the things that we're doing are our own money, the services that we decided to provide. Regarding our services, currently we have a legacy central office called the 5E. It's still very necessary for a lot of the things that happen today that we take for granted. And we have that in conjunction with a soft switch, with an IP switch, if you will. We all hear and read about IP, and we actually have the two switches sitting there working in tandem. They're both doing different functions, and someday when the IP technology matures, we'll be moving to that. But for now, it's very, very necessary to be using our existing switch as well, as that's the one that currently handles a lot of the 911 with the state. I was going to touch on triple play. Currently, you hear about triple play. Everybody's offering triple play. You know, I've got voice, video, data. When I moved from the metro up to the rural, my fellow engineers and they were teasing me, saying, "Well, if you folks ever get email out there, give me a shout." I was when we went out there and we started building the topology we have. It's fascinating. We have what I call true triple play. If you look at the screen, and what that is our voice, data, and video are totally integrated. So when you're sitting in your living room and your telephone rings, the caller ID pops up on your television screen. You can go back and you can look at caller ID on your television. You can manipulate those things. That's true integration. It's not I have cable, I have video, and voice and data separated. These are truly integrated, and it's wonderful, wonderful technology. The video portion of it. Where do we get our video? We have a company that is a consortium of ourselves and 17 other members called Broadband Visions. We built a digital cable TV head end, and it is located in Hutchinson. And we pull all of our television signals out of the air, and we distribute them among Hutchinson, over to our CLEC in Litchfield. And we also, that signal is distributed to the 17 other telephone companies, and they're offering that video and that data signal from anywhere from Bemidji and the Red Lake region all the way down to the Iowa border. There are 17 companies, and they're all currently, when you watch television in Bemidji, it's coming from Hutchinson. We put it on fiber optic. We're pumping it up to Bemidji, putting the local stations in along the way. And that's how a lot of us are doing our cable TV.
Just a couple questions in regard. So do you have a big satellite then?
Mr. Chair, yes, we have several.
Okay. Representative Beard.
Yes, that would be me. And I'm really sorry you confused me with Hop, Mr. Chairman.
But. You think you're sorry.
Mr. Morrow, you're fascinated with this discussion about video to your customers and to 17 other communities. Would this be considered what I would get in a classic cable TV subscription setting? And then I have a follow-up to that.
So we're
talking about ESPN, HBO, and everything in this, or just the local broadcast stations that you can see?
Mr. Morrow,
here, Representative. Currently, it is 160 all-digital channels, anywhere from your premium HBO pay-per-views to local channels to Turner Broadcasting, you name it. There's in excess, and we're adding channels all the time. Yes, ESPN, everything. We're adding all of them. And we do have all of them, I'm sorry.
And Representative Beard?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Morrow, how does this square with the video franchise that's in the statute now? Or are you the incumbent cable carrier? Or are you competing in any of these communities with other cable companies?
Ms. Morrow?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I get your names confused. They're flying all over the place here. I apologize for that. As far as how it squares with that, we are the incumbent in Hutchinson. We did have to go through the video franchising process. Mm-hmm. There was an existing cable company there, and we are in direct competition with them, as are most telcos that I know of, for sure. And Randy, maybe you can throw that figure out, but as far as my particular knowledge, most telcos offered are in direct competition with either the legacy cable company, satellite providers, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, of these 18 companies, some of them are the incumbent cable provider, as we traditionally know a cable provider in their communities. Some of them are doing it as a new entrant coming into the marketplace. The FCC and Congress years ago made a determination that a telephone company could not be a cable company in their telephone service area unless that community was less than 2,500 people, okay. In which case it was so small you probably wouldn't be getting a cable company to come in. And with that exception, in small communities, a telephone company could be the cable provider too. And I would guess, and maybe Mr. Martin knows too, because we have a lot of the same members, where I would guess maybe 20-25% of our independent telephone companies are also the incumbent cable provider, because the community is so small nobody else would come in and provide cable service.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Remember a couple years ago we had a cable, what we call the cable competition bill, which would have removed the build-out requirements, and one of the concerns we heard from some was that it was impossible to have another entrant in the market. That's why I'm very interested in this, how this works. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Morrow.
Mr. Chair, my last point regarding the video that I was going to touch on is currently within our ILEC operations, we have an 83% video reach, meaning I can reach 83% of the customers in my entire serving area with my video services. We're building those up. We're adding those RTs, those little college refrigerators like I talked about earlier, in the rural area all the time, and we hope to be at 100% fairly soon.
Representative Thiessen?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, on this, the connection you have from Iowa to Bemidji, is that your line? I mean, do you own that line, or how is that structured?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. Most of it is fiber optic cable that the companies are interconnected together. We use some other carrier equipment. We use some Shell is a cooperative effort on several independent telcos, and they have throughout the state that connects different companies. So, yes, sir, that is our facilities for the most part.
Further questions, members? I have a question about your pricing. Do you have a tier pricing plan then, or what do you charge for your services?
In regards to video, Chair,
mm-hmm.
Our basic, I should have brought a brochure. Our basic offering with most of the broadcast channels, with the exception of, you know, some of your expanded vision stuff, if you will, and some of your pay-per-view stuff, is approximately $25.95 a month. And that's for probably about 90 to 110 channels, if memory serves me correct. So it's, and that is digital. And that is, for the most part, you can get it in one stream. If it were, you know, just a couple living together, or in my case, if you have children and you need several streams of video, there's a probably $4 difference in that price if you're getting multiple streams versus one stream. But for the most part, those are the figures. So it's very competitively priced, I believe. And based on my former home Eden Prairie, I really believe that.
Very good. Any other questions, members, at this time? Representative Beard?
I live in the suburbs, and I have Comcast. You want to ask me about my pricing?
Well, thank you so much for your presentation. It's very helpful to get this information and hear what's going on in some of these towns.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I want to hit on a couple more bullet points.
Please go ahead.
Regarding our data build-out, our DSL, we are at 99.5% of our customers I can reach with DSL. That's the broadband that Randy was referring to earlier. Those bandwidths ranging anywhere from 128K, which is your lower level entry, to 2 meg offering, which is our current residential offering, to whatever you want. We currently have customers, we have some business customers that are taking 10 megabit services and 20 megabit services in the Ethernet form. So, and that piece of fiber optic cable that he was waving around here earlier actually came from our yard yesterday. And the bottom line is if you were to move your business to Hutchinson and you wanted terabits of bandwidth, you can get it. Here's a quick snapshot of the bandwidth that is being provided through the Broadband Visions Consortium for the video. We have it set up so that the internet feeds to this backbone, if you will. They come in from Bemidji, they come in from Hutchinson, and they're coming in from some different locations as well. So if we were to have problems, once we get that internet on our backbone, we still be able to provide the services from up north to down south. We are in the process, as soon as we can get them installed, into additional carriers and of adding an additional 200 megabits of bandwidth. So, as you can see from June of 03, I apologize, this is hard to read, to December of 06, we've gone from 100 megabits to over 450 megabits, and as I say, hopefully within the next few weeks, we'll be at 650 megabits. Wireless Internet is another offering we undertook outside of our serving territory. We have four towers that is, again, outside of our legacy serving area, and we're offering wireless Internet to rural customers and to customers of surrounding towns. Currently, we have 4 meg fibers that are going to these four locations, and we're offering this service at a 512K service. That's the fastest we've been requested to so far. If we have a customer that's out there that for some reason wants big bandwidth at their rural residence or at a rural business, we can turn it up. It's just a matter of turning on more capacity to these fiber and to these towers. 911. I'll touch on this briefly so I don't rain on the parade of your next presenter, Mr. Whitehead. But there are 7 telephone companies that partnered to create independent emergency services, which offers 911 services. We are currently offering services in over 60 counties in the state. I've got a map. I'll show you next to that real quickly. We offer the 911 network, the equipment that terminates the stuff, and the database, otherwise known as the MSAG. Currently, our operations, they manage the database, they update it, they refresh it, so your current street addresses, home addresses, changes are current. We get those information from excess of 75 companies and almost 700,000 records daily. We operate a couple 911 call centers in the metro as well. Hennepin, Parver, soon to be Ramsey, the Edina PD, and Burnsville PD. We also work with 12 wireless providers, 12 cell phone providers with their 911 services. Last fall, we worked with the MnDOT and OnStar on a test program where OnStar was implementing a service, they're testing a service, so if you were to have a rollover, a crash in your vehicle, it would know to call the right 911 center to dispatch the appropriate personnel to the location and with the information, number of airbags deployed, all the vital statistics that a vehicle can have, and quite frankly, some stuff that would blow your mind. We were one of 2 operators that did that successfully with them. We are also in the process of testing with VoIP. It's in the infant stages as far as 911. There are a lot of things, a lot of curves that VoIP technology throws at 911, because you can take your laptop and you can go different locations and it still looks like you're sitting in Hutchinson. So we're working on a lot of different issues and trying to accommodate that and be accommodating to that technology. Quick snapshot of the state of Minnesota. The blue counties are the counties that are currently being served by IES. The yellow are by the incumbent provider, Quest. The red look like hockey pucks are where our selective routers sit throughout the states. Those are our partners.
I have a question from Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just thought I'd make it easy for you, Mr. Morrow, on names. I'll ask you a question.
Thank you, Mr. Morrow.
I'm handing around a section of Minnesota Statute 403.07. And, Mr. Chair, I've had an opportunity to talk with Mr. Morrow and Mr. Young about IES services. There's an issue that's come up in Minnesota, and you'll see in the statute that's coming around. Under Homeland Security funding from the federal government, counties receive the equipment necessary to be able to make outgoing 911 calls. So, for example, if a tornado is coming to a community, the local emergency management service can, in a sense, hit a button and a phone call will be made to every home that a tornado is approaching. For example, my county, Nicollet County, received a $30,000 grant to obtain this equipment. My understanding from Mr. Morrow from IES is that Minnesota law 403.07 subdivision 4 prevents Mr. Morrow's company from releasing the database to our local counties to make these calls. I've worked with Mr. Eliff and Mr. Sullivan in the last couple of days to try to figure out this problem and also come up with a potential solution. I'm going to turn, though, to Mr. Eliff to just talk briefly about what you discovered, Mr. Eliff, and a proposal that then Mr. Morrow would ask you to respond to.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. Well, Mr. Sullivan and I just heard about this very recently. You'll notice in Subdivision 4, or actually in Subdivision 3, it mentions federal law United States Code, Title 47, Section 222, which applies to this kind of data, but is relevant only to telecommunications companies. Essentially, I just tried to figure out a way to make this work. And I think by making a small change in Subdivision 4, essentially, which says now the names, addresses, and telephone numbers provided to 911 system are private data and can be used for identifying location or identity or both of a person calling a 911 public safety answering point. To add a second a number two there, can also be used for use by a public safety answering point to notify the public of an emergency. I think that would allow your company to provide that information, and I hope for everything to work smoothly. Would that help?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the issue about the sharing of the data, we did go through this quite extensively. There was some question as to the existing state statute about the data privacy issue. We have had our council work on this, and they found that there is they believe to be a federal statute that overrides it, that we should be able to do this. As far as the language you're proposing, I don't have a problem with it. I don't see why we would have a problem with it. I mean, we're all for safety. Upon further research and approval from our council, absolutely. I would love to cooperate, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. To date, it's my understanding that we have met with the council and that we do believe we can do it. We're drawing up contracts and we are in the process of marching on the road of doing this exact same thing. So,
Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Morrow. I just wanted to talk about this right now, committee members. As we had Mr. Morrow here, I will bring language to a future meeting. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention. And you have some more to finish up?
Mr. Chair, no. I finally hit the final slide, so if you have any thoughts, questions, I'm more than happy to take them, but I appreciate the time of sitting in front of you folks.
Thank you. Members, any further questions right now? Well, thank you very much for coming down to the committee this morning and sharing your information. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just a few challenges that we as small telephone companies are facing. One is, I think you've been able to gather from the conversation this morning, the technological changes are increasing at an exponential rate. We have a hard time keeping up with the new technologies. It's obviously expensive to do that. We no more than get some equipment installed, and we have to replace it with a newer and faster version of that. We hear a lot of talk about, well, why are you putting those lines in the ground? Everything's going to be going over the air. We have cell phones today. We have VoIP. We have all of these fancy things. What are you spending money on that technology for? The fact of the matter is that all of those technologies are needed in rural Minnesota as well as in the cities. They need our infrastructure to travel over to happen. A cell phone conversation, for example, a very small percentage of the route that it travels is actually over the air. When you make a cell phone call, it goes from your cell phone to a tower that may just be a few miles away from you. It goes down from that tower, travels over landlines, often in rural Minnesota are landlines, to either someone's home or business or up another tower and then to another cell phone that's 2 or 3 miles away from that tower. With VoIP, voice over the internet, we've seen the ads on TV, the Vonages and such. They can't provide service without our network as well. So we need our network in rural Minnesota. Quite frankly, our competitors need our network in rural Minnesota as well. If our network is allowed to deteriorate, all advanced services in rural Minnesota will deteriorate as well, which is why we're committed to keeping our network up to date with the technologies that our customers and our communities are asking us for. We're in an increasingly competitive marketplace. Today, every one of our customers have choices as to where they can get their service, whether it's from VoIP, whether it's from a cell company, whether it's from a cable company that's providing telephone service today. We're facing many forms of competition. We're seeing it in our line count. We're losing access lines every year. It's not a precipitous loss that we're going to be out of business in 3 or 4 years, but we are losing 2 or 3% of our customers every year to cell phones, to cable, and other competitors. We know that we have to keep current. One of the reasons we've gone to the triple play is so that we can broaden our base of business, so that we're not absolutely reliant on just telephone business. But we are facing competition. The frustration that we have is that there is an unlevel and uneven amount of regulation that is imposed on various participants in the competitive marketplace. We have more regulatory obligations than our competitors do. That makes it more difficult for us to be nimble in a competitive marketplace where our competitors don't have those same forms of regulation. You have recognized that over the years and have slowly been relieving us of some of the regulations that don't make any sense any longer. Just as an example, up until a couple of years ago, we couldn't bundle our services without getting approval. Obviously, bundling saves customers money. You eliminated that restriction. We can do that. A couple of years ago, we couldn't even offer promotional offerings to our customers, except on a short-term preliminary basis. If we wanted to say free installation of a service, we had to go to the Public Utilities Commission to get approval. That often took 2 or 3 months to get the offering, the free installation or whatever. It could only be for a couple of months. Then we had to go back and tell the commission how we did. In the meantime, our competitor in the wireless business could dream up a promotional offering in the shower in the morning and have it on the shelf in the afternoon. You understood the disadvantages of that and how in this competitive marketplace probably doesn't make much sense. You relieved us of those regulatory obligations and restrictions in offering promotions. There are some others that we have that we may be coming to you with during this year. Minor tweaks, we believe, to the law that would make the marketplace, we think, operate better and make it a more, I hate to use this term because it's been overused, level playing field in the amount of regulation that the various participants in the marketplace have.
We have a question from Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Young, over the last couple of years, we have done some fun things, I think, for the consumers, the ratepayers, who've been the true winners in this. One of the things we did wrestle with, though, and didn't have a lot of success with, was long-distance charges in greater Minnesota, long-line carriers being able to negotiate lower rates for terminating a call or originating a call, particularly in the smaller local exchanges. Having seen how VoIP has entered the marketplace, in the largest extent, those, I think, are long-distance. It becomes a free. It just becomes part of your package. There is no more terminating charge or originating charge, or is there? Has that actually been an end run around the regulatory process by the marketplace, an example of technology, I guess, actually taking care of a problem that we were wrestling with here, and has that had a dampening effect or a lowering effect on long-distance rates for your customers in rural Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, that is a difficulty. VoIP travels over the Internet. It doesn't go through our switches per se. We don't record those calls so that we don't get what's called access charges. They don't pay us for using our network, for using our switch. They, in effect, are using our network free to compete with us, which obviously makes it difficult. That is a federal issue. The federal courts, the Minnesota Commission, was the first in the country to step up to the plate and say those are phone calls. If it walks like a duck and it quacks it like a duck, it's a duck. The federal court said, no, it ain't a duck. Said it's a data service, and the states can't regulate it. And as a result, the PUC has not been able to regulate it, and we have not been able to figure out a way to collect for those long-distance calls that are being made over that network. That and the erosion of long-distance calls over the network that takes place as people use their cell phones to make long-distance calls rather than their traditional landline calls are eroding the revenues that we receive from the long-distance companies called access charges. About a third of our revenues come from these access charges. That's what we get from the long-distance companies, the cellular companies, and others for using our network. If those monies were to go away, or if the Universal Service Fund at the federal level were to go away, and that's about a third of our revenues too, over $150 million a year comes into rural Minnesota from the federal Universal Service Fund. There's only one other area to make up those revenues, and that's from the local customers. If you look at the true cost of providing basic telephone service in rural Minnesota, and I'm not sure what Hutchinson's situation is, but the actual cost for us of providing that service can be anywhere from $50 to, in some areas of northern Minnesota, close to $100 a month. That's obviously not affordable for anyone to pay. And as a result, we have these two other revenue streams, access charges and the Universal Service Fund and other support mechanisms, that allow us to keep basic telephone rates in rural Minnesota affordable, on average probably around $15 a month. If those two other sources were to be eliminated or to be eroded substantially, you could see the cost of basic service in rural Minnesota double or triple, which we don't think would be good for our communities and wouldn't be good for the state's economy either.
Representative Eason, just a brief follow-up on that. So can you just clarify for me, of people providing what we would consider to be phone service, long-distance phone service, who's paying those charges and who's not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, we have an issue that in our industry we're calling phantom traffic right now. The long-distance companies pay us so much per minute for using our network and our switch.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, so that's like Quest, and I mean, who are those companies?
Everyone's changing their names now, Mr. Okay. Chair, Representative Thiessen. The traditional AT&Ts, the MCIs, the Spitzers,
okay,
and many other smaller players. Additionally, the wireless companies use our network, obviously, to begin to complete calls that are going to our customers. VoIP, cable companies that are obviously interconnected to the overall network as well. Many of them are paying, they're saying they don't want to pay as much, or as a docket that has been before the PUC, long-distance companies were arguing that, well, the network's there, they ought to be able to use it for free. Which is like me walking up to Northwest Airlines and saying, you have a plane going to Denver and you have an empty seat on it, why can't I ride on it for free? Others are what we call phantom traffic, and they are manipulating the caller information that accompanies the telephone call so that neither we nor Quest, who maybe is handing that call off to us, know where that phone call is coming from, so we don't know where to bill it to. We're not sure exactly, and it varies from company to company, what percentage of our traffic is phantom traffic and is gaming the system, if you will. The network and the financial arrangements in the industry were created 50, 60, 70 years ago when there were very few players in the industry. Everything was almost done on a handshake. Everybody knew everybody else. Everybody trusted everybody else. It worked well. In the highly competitive marketplace that we have today with so many new entrants, they're gaming the system that used to work well with a gentle person's agreement and a handshake.
And I could just follow up, and that's helpful to understand. And just to kind of back up, and so the long-distance companies are paying this charge. You said the VoIP folks don't have to pay that charge. And who of those groups, the cable companies, do they pay the interconnection fees?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, he said, for the most part, the telephone, the long distance companies are paying. There are some of the smaller that are gaming the system. Some of the wireless companies are paying. Others, there's no law that requires them to come to an agreement in a negotiation with the contract. We continue to negotiate with them without being able to come to resolution. We, by law, are not, nor would we want to, I think, disconnect service and say, well, your wireless company doesn't have a contract with us, so any calls that you're going to make to any of our customers, we're not going to terminate. We can't, nor I think would we want to do that.
Mr. Morrow, do you want to add something?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative. I have been on a subcommittee that has been working on this exact issue for the past couple of years in conjunction with Quest, and it's called the Intercarrier Compensation Subcommittee. what we found was Quest is a tandem provider. Forgive me for speaking with my hands here for a second. But not every small telco has a connection to AT&T and to MCI and to you name the carrier. So what happens is those calls come into what we call a tandem provider, being Quest, because they do have connections to those folks. And we all connect to the tandem provider. And what Quest found was that they were getting these calls and they were turning around and handing it to me and they're saying, wait a minute, I'm paying you way too much for what I'm getting. We dove into it and we did a very, very in-depth data study on that, and we found out that, you know, the old adage of garbage in, garbage out, they were getting long-distance calls with call records of 0000. Who is that? I don't know. But that's an industry standard for this is a bad record. Well, the bad records went through the roof with the advent of IP and some other services. We worked in conjunction with Quest to try to minimize those. We haven't gone to the step of going to the commission asking not to accept those calls because they could be legitimate calls, and then it's going to be bad news on the network. If you can't get through and you don't care that your provider is handing it to me a 000, you're paying for a service. To be blunt and quite honest with you, there are some companies that have sprung up. They don't need to be in Minnesota. They can be anywhere. And they have sprung up saying, I'll take your traffic and I'll hand it off for you for cheaper rates than what that tandem provider may be doing. Well, the bottom line is what they're doing is they're taking that traffic, they're taking a minimal cut, stripping the data and handing it to you, and every call you get is a local call. We found that with our data study. So, you know, when you talk about inter-carrier compensation and access reform and those things, for your question, quite frankly, until we get the data right to know what are legitimate calls and what are not legitimate calls, the federal government needs to look at that first, clear up the tandem traffic so we at least have legitimate information to address access reform.
Representative Beard?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Morrow, tandem, what did you say that word? I'm trying to get my...
When you're talking, Chair, Representative, tandem.
Tandem.
T-A-N-D-E-M, yes.
Okay. I'm going to pay attention to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Although some days it feels like we're on the end of a can.
Any other questions for the testifiers or the witnesses today? Thank you very much for your helpful information. That's very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We certainly appreciate the time, and we're available for any questions individually or as a committee.
Thank you. Let's move on to our second half. Mr. Whitehead and 911. You have about 25 minutes. Think you can do it in 25 minutes?
I don't mean to give it to you.
All right.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead. Identify yourself for the record and start up.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Whitehead. I am the Program Director for Armor 911 in the Department of Public Safety, and I might note for the committee the fact that at one time the 911 program was part of the Department of Administration. I think regularly appeared before this committee, and then was transferred about 3 years ago to the Department of Public Safety, where it's administered on that side. I'll just give you a brief history of the 911 program. Started in 1970, and in large part, that program has mimicked the transition, the tremendous transition in the telecom industry. That history, starting out with the Bell operating systems, the AT&T breakup in the competitive environment, the implementation of the wireless, and now the discussion of VoIP telecommunications. And what I would note for the members of the committee and is the fact that VoIP is kind of a generic term, and we often confuse that term quite frequently as telecommunications over the internet, when in fact it's internet protocol. And what you'll find is there's a number of providers that are actually VoIP providers presently are being regulated by the Public Utility Commission. And as part of a recent event that was put on by one of the conferences, we went to one of the large competitive local exchange carriers, and they took us into a room and said, here's our DSM 100 switch, and takes up a room, you know, much larger than this room, and then took us into their soft switch next door where they were providing VoIP communications. The DSM switch handles 64,000 customers. The soft switch in a room about as big as one of the bathrooms outside here handles 100,000 customers. So that, you know, the idea that the industry is going to a VoIP environment is without a doubt occurring. It's this question of how it's going to be regulated and so forth. And, you know, obviously the environment of internet calls over the, or VoIP calls over the internet may in fact be something that is difficult. It's going to be difficult to say whether that's going to be the true nature of telecommunications in the future. But anyway, I'll giving you the history of the 911 program. Started out with local with a local environment connecting central offices direct to the PSAPs. We've now gone to the selective router service, which is what Monty Morrow was discussing. IES is one of our principal partners in providing selective router services, to where the connection is to the selective router and calls are routed to each county's PSAP appropriately, is the environment we're in right now. Once wireless came into place, we were challenged with getting wireless calls to be routed appropriately. The FCC finally moved into that realm and provided the regulatory environment where wireless had been required to provide 911 service, to provide reasonable location services or location information with the call. And in large part, I will reference you to a report, the 2006 911 report that was distributed to the committee in the back. You'll see that Minnesota is doing very well as far as implementing enhanced 911 services throughout the state so that there's good location information for the most part. There are some challenges there. The technology still is difficult with respect to exact location information to FCC standards. But as far as the implementation process with Quest and IES, our two partners in providing 911 service, we're actually doing very well. I will spend a moment telling you about the economics because I believe you're probably familiar with the fact that about 2 years ago we were really, the revenues weren't supporting the cost of the network and so forth. And in fact, what we found out is the expansion of wireless and the implementation of wireless service, which really involved a transition from local number identification to enhanced number identification, hooking up to the selective routers, occurred quite rapidly. And our monitoring of costs got away from us in an industry that was pretty much transitioning in itself. And we were at a point where we were about $7 to $9 million in the hole with the program, with debts going back as long as 10 years ago. And I can tell you that based upon the fee increase that we were allocated, our negotiations with all the telephone companies we were dealing with, we resolved those and actually paid them off early and paid them off for less than what we expected. So we're moving ahead and we have a good handle on our costs, what the costs are, and in most cases have a good handle on where the costs are going for us in the system. Again, you have to recognize that it's a changing environment. At one time it was all a bundled service and you just paid a bill, one bill to one vendor and knew how much it was going to cost. Now it's become a very diverse network where we manage over 1,000 contracts to keep the 911 network in place. And it does, it is a challenge. We do that with four people and make sure that we're staying on top of all those things. But we feel very confident that we've got control of our expenses. We know what the costs are. And aside from the fact every time a competitive local exchange decides to open up, the law currently states that we contract with them and pay their costs. We're subsidizing the competitiveness of the market, so to speak, through that environment. We feel that we have a comfortable handle upon the costs. I would kind of give you a way of organizing the 911 network. There's really three pieces of it. It's the connectivity to the telephone companies, to the selective routers. We call them the telephone company trunks. There's a common network. It's the common selective routers and the Alley network, which is the Alley database that provides the information for location for information for each of the calls. And then there's the connectivity to the PSAPs. And there's a very well-established local network, the selective routers and the connections to the PSAPs. It's the telephone company trunks and some of the costs of providing that network that continue to be our challenge. And that becomes a factor of the nature of the network at the present time. And again, I'll go back to in the 80s and 90s, it was a very local service. The local telephone company was providing service that was connected to the PSAP. Now you have telecommunications where one company can provide service throughout the state from one central office. So in effect, what happens when one selective router comes in and decides to offer service in all 87 counties from one central location, we end up paying the cost of those services to connect up to all the selective routers. And that's our factor that we're trying, that we have to control in the future and take a look at. I think really what I, you know, what may be of interest to the committee is the fact that this VoIP environment is a challenge for all of us. And when I say that, first, I have to note that the Minnesota was the first state to take one of the big providers of VoIP over the internet type service on, and asked to regulate them. The PUC litigated with a company called Vonage, and Vonage still is one of those big providers of telecommunications service. In an order in June of 2005, the FCC said Vonage was required to connect regularly to the 911 network, and as directly as the FCC is able to, I think, said that they have to contribute fees for the cost of the network. So, in essence, that did, from the 911 perspective, answer some of our questions. Is they, in fact, very quickly were required to connect to the 911 network and started contributing fees to us. As Monty Morrow said, though, we continue to have a great challenge with the 911 with VoIP providers over the fact that they can operate from anywhere in this country and access the network from anywhere in this country. So do we have local jurisdiction over them to say, you know, you're not paying your fees, you're not contributing to the costs? What most of them are doing are accessing the network through a gateway. Sprint Level 3, a couple of the competitive telephone companies are providing that gateway service and getting them regularly into the network. So we've been working with those companies to identify those people and preserve that revenue and so forth. As Monty Morrow said, the wear line is declining somewhat. Our counts demonstrate that there's approximately 6 million telephone customers in the state of Minnesota. About half of those are wired line, about half of them are wireless. I believe you'll probably see that some of the erosion may be as they expand their fiber network and provide DSL service, people get rid of their modem lines. But you may see some of that is also erosion to the wireless carriers and possibly erosion to the VoIP carriers. As I say, we include the VoIP carriers as the wireline, and would hope that that's a leveling out and there'll be a sustained number there. Prior year, as I previously indicated, our prior year obligations are resolved. They are totally resolved. We currently have two competing markets out there, our vendors, IES and Quest. That does pose one of our continuing challenges with 911. Is the fact that there is no interoperability between those two vendors where calls can be transferred between the networks or where their databases are compatible and we can access both databases. And so that's one of our long-term challenges there. The only solution at this time is to hook up the counties along the border to both networks. In other words, put in more trunk connectivity to provide that. And we've taken a position that there is, you know, everybody uniformly agrees the telecommunications network is transitioning. I think you'll find fairly good consensus over the fact that what we did with wireless was made them act like a wireline telephone company to access the 911 network. And the discussion amongst NENA, the National Emergency Number Association, APCO, is that the reality is the 911 network is probably on the verge of transitioning to some sort of IP-based type of technology. And to that end, we're actually at the present time, the RFP is on the street, will close on February 12th. We've got a RFP for what we would consider to be a substantial discussion and assessment of a modernization of the 911 network. A few states have already started to do that. The absolute what that network will look like is still up in the air. as far as the absolute standards, but we felt it was time to discuss where we're going with this network and what the next VoIP-type network might look like in that respect. With that, we hope the FCC continues to help discuss what they call the VoIP or the data-enabled telecommunications-type services defines that better. But I think we're positioning ourselves to move ahead and look at the future. And what I will tell you, in those states that have provided an answer, actually it's been the small telephone companies that have provided the answers, the consortiums of small companies. It's not been the large Bell operating systems that seem to be coming up with some of the answers. Doesn't mean that they can't. And we certainly want to provide an environment where they all can, but it's been the smaller telephone companies in conjunction with the cable providers that have provided answers as to where the 911 network's going. So I hope I leave you today with the idea that we're looking to the future. We're working with our partners to provide a better 911 network, a network, as Monty Morrow referred to, that when your car crashes, can actually access the network and report the location of the accident and details of the accident so that public safety providers can get to that accident much more quickly. Those kind of services that disabled people or people, hearing impaired people, can access 911 network through their phones instead of I've seen TTY devices in every PSAP because it's required by law, but there's no way through text messaging to access the 911 network. That we're looking to try to provide what is needed in the 911 network in the future.
Thank you very much, Mr. Whitehead. Could you say a little bit more about the Vonage case and 911 and what's going forward with the PUC and AG's office and so forth?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure of the stat. I know that case is still continuing because it becomes a matter of local regulation, but in large part, my understanding was that the case went to the federal courts. The federal courts said, no, the states had no right to regulate the Vonage type voice over IP providers. They were data services. And then the FCC got the message, frankly, from Congress and a lot of states, that there was a need to regulate this. There was, at the very least, a need to regulate it to make sure that people's expectation of having a reliable 911 service was provided. So in June of 2005, they did issue a decision that required them to connect to the 911 network. And, like I say, provided in a footnote and said, they can be made to contribute. They can be located through the competitive local exchanges providing them access to that network and should be able to, should submit fees. So to the degree it relates to 911, I believe the question, the FCC has made it pretty clear that they have to provide access to that 911 network and do so reliably. Now, the other issues with respect to regulating it as a telecom, in other words, the state's right to regulate them, I'm not sure about that one. And that one, I would say, we have a very large network out there right now, the wireless network, that's not locally regulated also. So at the federal level, that's not something that's foreign to them. But I don't know what the progress of that might be.
All right, thank you, sir. Mr. Representative Szymanski? Oh, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Whitehead, going back to the 9/11 system going to be in IP-based, do you think at some point we're going to look at a per-number charge, instead of any other way of looking at it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, that may in fact be in the future. I think Department of Commerce did a fairly aggressive study of that issue. And at the end, once the FCC came out with the decision, we had the legislature had actually amended our statute and added packet-based services to our statute, which seemed to apply to them. And once the FCC said they were supposed to contribute, the immediate incentive to do that was changed. But I think what people are waiting for right now is the fact that the FCC, in fact, is talking about a per-number fee that may be applicable in the future. It probably is the clearest way to get down to the access line count, which we we currently look at. VoIPEX services, just the idea of an access line is just something different than what we're accustomed to in the telecommunications industry. As the FCC said in the Vonage decision or the data-enabled service decision, it probably means a subscriber and so forth. But so I guess the short answer is I would suspect in the future we'll see a continued discussion of that point as a way of accessing, you know, a way of dealing with that type of service. And yet there are some problems with that also. In that there's a lot of numbers floating out there, and monitoring exactly what numbers are in service and aren't in service tends to be a problem also.
All right, thank you very much. Any other questions from committee members? Well, thank you very much for the information provided and the handouts. We'll definitely give us something to chew on here. Members, I think that's going to take care of it for this morning. Thank you for your kind attention. Meeting adjourned.